Welcome to the Barnes Review History Hour. This is your host, John Friend. Today is Friday, August 12th, 2022. The Barnes Review History Hour is a program where I will be interviewing contributors to the Barnes Review History Magazine, a bi-monthly print and digital publication dedicated to bringing history into accord with the facts. Please do consider subscribing to the Barnes Review if you are not already. Check out barnesreview.org for all the details. Today I am joined by Carl Hamers, one of the leading contributors to the Barnes Review. All right, Carl Hamers, welcome to the program, sir. How are you today?
Excellent, John. Thank you. Good to be here.
Yeah, thank you so much for taking the time. This is a long overdue conversation. You are a regular contributor to the Barnes Review, the bi-monthly revisionist history magazine that was founded by the late Willis Cardo all the way back in 1994. And of course, I would encourage everybody to consider subscribing to the publication if you do not already. The website is barnesreview.org, and you can find all subscription details as well as other books for sale. So please do consider subscribing to the publication. And so you contribute to the magazine. And you've also had articles published on the Occidental Observer, which is one of the best pro-white commentary websites on the internet. So to kind of get started, can you please just introduce yourself and talk about your background and experience in the alternative media?
Right. I go by the name Carl Hamers. I first published at Barnes in September, October 2021. We'll talk more about that essay. But prior to that, I had a small town community radio show for 1 hour a month. And that was devoted to the topic of genetically modified organisms. It's one of the myths I was penetrating and myth busting. And some people there encouraged me to do some television programs. Again, a small community television station, and we did three television shows. So that was some of my involvement in media. I was the host. And I've always been a big reader, writer. But we'll talk some more about how I got into revisionism. But I think that's a summary of my involvement in media.
Okay, yeah, no, that's very interesting. So were you approaching the topic of, like, GMOs from, like, a skeptic? Like, you're against the, you know, GMO foods and sort of, like, alternative health, I guess? That seems like a kind of like an alternative health-type topic.
Totally. Yes, exactly.
Good. That's right up my alley.
Good. I devoted myself to natural health from a young age, actually around the age of 22. And stuck with that. I knew GMOs were, you know, dangerous to our health, just like vaccines.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Wow, that's interesting. So you kind of had approached things from that angle, which is obviously very, very important, especially today with this alleged COVID pandemic, which we can maybe get into later on in the discussion. Well, let's kind of jump right into your introduction to revisionism. How would you describe historical revisionism to an average person? And can you also talk about how you became interested in the concept?
Yes. I think we should develop our ability to describe revisionism to people. We should actually do trainings and hold seminars and, send our emissaries out into the population with knowledge on how to do it. Because it's very difficult. I like the way Barnes defines it, bringing history in line with the facts, and the Journal of Politically Incorrect History. The concept of political incorrectness is something I think most people will understand what it means. You know, it's basically a censorship of the truth. I haven't really put my mind to how to define political revisionism. One way I think about it is Most people know that the winners write the history books. But more people need to know that the losers also write history books, or people write about the losers from their perspective. And that is a powerful source of historical revisionism and what I call honest history. And that's a lot of what the books that Barnes publishes are. History from the perspective of the losers, which gives us an excellent, binocular view, a penetrating depth into the truths of history from when you see it from both sides.
Yeah, that's a good way of looking at it, actually. I tend to think of revisionism as basically like the concept of free speech and, freedom of inquiry tied directly to the practice of history. So, in a modern context, there's all sorts of, free speech dissidents and activists on all sides of the political spectrum, from the left, from the right, from the center. People are arguing over all sorts of important and controversial contemporary issues, public policies, political philosophies, and of course, other ideas. So this same sort of mindset, questioning the narrative, engaging in critical thinking, being skeptical of what the authorities or the experts promote, and having, just healthy debates, when applied to history is really how I would describe historical revisionism. And I think you make a good point that, the victors, of course, write the history books, and they often write it from an extremely biased or, in some cases, entirely fraudulent perspective. I mean, there's been, the idea of fake news is very powerful and very real, but, you apply that concept to history and you get fake history, which is exactly what we have and what we're dedicated to combating at the Barnes Review.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's a psychological operation and a social engineering program, the way history has been spun and distorted.
Oh, and, absolutely.
It requires courage. It can be dangerous to engage in historical revisionism. It's that heavily suppressed, as you know.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, thinking independently and questioning authorities is increasingly more and more dangerous in modern America. It's really a travesty when this is really like the bedrock of Western civilization. The bedrock of what used to be our educational system was being able to think for yourself. Right. And using your own brain to assess information, to, to think independently and critically. And that is totally out the window in modern America. It's you very rarely will come across anybody that's thinking for themselves and thinking critically and independently about information they're consuming. Go ahead.
My assessment, and, it's very difficult to be accurate about this, but I sense that that's changing. Our movement is growing exponentially. We've probably passed a kind of tipping point. More and more people are learning the truths of history, and it's not just important, it's urgent to understand history for the current survival of humanity and the fate of the earth. I mean, it's that urgent.
Yes. Yeah, I agree. No, you're right, and we definitely have made a lot of progress. I mean, there's certainly a lot more people aware of these sorts of issues, aware that there is another side to World War II, for example, or to the official narrative of 9/11 or COVID, for that matter. You look at more modern issues. So people are becoming more and more skeptical, and they're looking for alternative explanations, for alternative perspectives.
Yes.
So I think you're right. Yeah, we certainly have made a lot of progress in that regard, but we have a lot more work to do, for sure.
Right. Every incident like 9/11 or the COVID, scandal generates more people that are questioning the official narratives.
And yes.
Each one of these outrageous lies that are, introduced onto the world stage, into the public mind, reasonably intelligent people are suddenly saying, now, wait a minute. Something's not right here. This is some kind of lie. And it propels them into a revisionist approach, kind of a myth-busting process that then expands into all the other myths that they've been in. And I think maybe none more important than World War II revision, because that has led directly to the world we live in today and its terrible problems.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely. Well, one thing that I've kind of focused on over the years and you know, talked about on podcasts and written about is how the media is so psychologically exploitative. And it literally is like a mind control program. And also the way history is even presented. Certainly, like very, very powerful historical narratives relating to World War II, for example. But there, you know, there's also other events. Like the propaganda associated with World War II, for instance, is extremely, extremely psychologically and emotionally exploitative. It's designed to attack, you know, to attack a target audience, in this case, like an entire population of people, like the United States or Western Europe or really the world for that matter, and to prevent them from actually thinking critically about the information. It, you know, basically bypasses and sort of like exploits the mind, I think.
Oh, yes.
And these people are experts at this. I mean, they've been doing this for a very, very long time. I mean, Edward Bernays wrote Propaganda. If anybody's not familiar with that book, sit down and read it. I don't even think it's that long, you know, where he basically describes his process and describes how whoever controls the flow of information and whoever can, like, manipulate the masses emotionally and psychologically really is the sovereign, is who's actually ultimately in control. And that's so true.
Oh, yeah.
And it takes something to sort of snap out of it, because we have been subjected to a literal mind control program with the way the media operates, with the way history is presented to us in school, in Hollywood, the way it's explained by politicians and historians
absolutely.
And stuff. So,
nothing anywhere close to the scope and scale of World War II propaganda. And that itself, John, should clue us in to the importance of the truth of World War II. Why would they overlay it with these lies and this propaganda so thickly for so long? It's been 100 years since Adolf Hitler emerged onto the world stage in 1922. You know, and the propaganda on this historical era has only thickened and accelerated and expanded. That itself should clue us in that the truth about this historical time is the most important thing we need to know.
Right. Yeah.
They wouldn't like lie so much about it if it wasn't so important that we know the truth.
Well, I mean, it really is the bedrock of the modern world.
It's the
linchpin of this, you know, unipolar America centric world order that has ruled international relations since World War II. It's the bedrock of our like modern historical paradigm of understanding the world. And frankly, the official story, you know, that demonizes Hitler, demonizes National Socialist Germany and its allies, and has sort of elevated the alleged Jewish Holocaust into like almost like a religious, you know, experience for people, is just not, frankly, just not true. I mean, that's a thing. Like, people have like sat down and gone through this and explained this all in great detail and you know, in a very scholarly, scientific way, but it's just suppressed and you know, it's very difficult for people to overcome the emotions and actually assess the information objectively.
It's
incredible. And that was one thing that really struck me right away when I was you know, first sort of becoming aware of the concept of revisionism. And it's interesting today because, I mean, like with love him or hate him, you know, former President Trump, he did popularize the concept of fake news. He really targeted the media, discredited the mass media in the eyes of many people. And I mean, this idea of fake news, as I sort of explained earlier, it is an absolutely valid and legitimate concept. I mean, like the media truly is the enemy of the people, which is something also Trump said, you know, when he was president.
Oh, yeah. And the media. Apparently, he appeared to be in a conflict with the main media. At this point, can I share my personal story of how I entered into a study of revisionism? And that would lead to how I started writing for the Barnes Review.
Yeah, absolutely. Go ahead.
In 2015, when I was producing these television shows, there was a man on the technical crew that was helping us, you know, he was working with the studio and knew the technology. And at one point we were working in the studio, he said to me, "I think the Monsantos are Jews." Well, at the time, John, I had no concept of, I have no context to evaluate this statement. It was a complete blank to me. It meant nothing. I was puzzling over it. Like, why would anyone say that, and why does it matter? So I had no awareness of the Jewish issue. And as my, you know, work with this man went on, at one point he offered me a book. It was called The Controversy of Zion by Douglas Reed. And I'm open to, if someone thinks I need to know something that they've learned that was influential in their life, I'm open to looking at it. So I took the book, and I did read it. It's a rather thick book. It's basically a concise history of the Jewish people. I'd say the Jewish race, from the Old Testament times up until 1954, when the book was finished being written, and it wasn't published until 76. And that was my introduction. That was a revelation. And my relation with this man continued. He gave me he printed out his own copies of the booklet, Did 6 Million Really Die, by Richard Harwood, which is a 28-page booklet with, you know, pictures and captions and text and charts and maps. I think it was the PhD thesis of a British history student. And, you know, throughout my life, the Holocaust edifice had been built in my mind from all the various sources that just come at us from every direction, comic books and Hollywood and government. Well, in 1 hour of reading this booklet, the edifice was a pile of ruins. It was just destroyed by the scholarly research in this booklet. And in fact, there's even a cartoon in this booklet, which shows a house of cards, literally a pyramid made out of playing cards, standing on the floor of a room. And across the room is an open window, and there's these lines that look like wind coming in the window. And the end of the wind is like, it's sort of loosely shaped into the shape of a fist. And on the house of cards is the label, The Holocaust. And on the wind coming into the window is the label revisionism.
And that's good. Yeah,
exactly the experience I had when reading this book, the House of Cards. The only reason the House of Cards was standing in my mind is because it had never been challenged. All it took was 1 hour's reading, and I was sold. And then of course I had to go on with the process of cognitive dissonance and like this disorientation that I'd believed something so thoroughly that was not only false, but like when I look back on it, I was amazed that I had believed any of it. It was so absurd. The gas chambers and the cattle cars and the evil Dr. Mengele and, you know, obviously, anti-German atrocity stories and war propaganda. And so just to finish this account, which we should all think about, this is what I mean by we can develop emissaries, because this man was very graceful and very effective at introducing me without being insistent or shrill about it. Just, you know, feeding me material. And eventually he told me, look, I'm living on a homestead, and I don't have a place to store my books. I have a whole library of this material. So you just bought a house in 2015. Let me store my books in your house where they'll be in better condition, you know. And you can feel free to read them, of course. So we did that. He must have had 200 volumes of revisionism. It was George Duncan Rockwell, David Duke, you know, plenty of books from Barnes, The Forced War, just magnificent historical revisionist works, and other topics, the Jewish question, you know, Hervé Riesen. I can go on about all the books, and I plunged right into them. But at some point, he also said, I don't have a mailbox at my homestead, so I have to get my mail from a post deposit, what they call it, a post office box. And I have this magazine that comes every 2 months. And it would be easier if I had it sent to your address and I could pick it up there. And of course, you could read it. Well, I agreed to this as well. And of course, the magazine was the Barnes Review. And, well, I was thrilled. The first time it came in the mail, I was just struck by the beauty of the covers and the art inside. Each issue, I feel, is a kind of collector's item. And that's when I started reading the Barnes Review. And that's basically my account of how I was introduced to revisionism by the mentorship of one person. And I think we could advocate for that for others.
Yeah, wow, that's an incredible story. And, you know, isn't it funny how when you actually sit down and just hear the other side, like the dissident side of World War II, the revisionist side of World War II, how much more sense everything makes? I mean, like, yeah. I mean, at least that was the case for me. I never was, like, really, really, like, emotionally tied to, like, the Holocaust story. I don't really remember, like, being indoctrinated by it or with it, like, in school and stuff. I mean, certainly we talked about it, and it was part of, part of history in high school and even in college. But I don't remember it being, like, the central theme of anything, really. I mean, I don't think we took a specific course on it, although I'm sure there were. I know there was a history class at the college I went to that was specifically focused on the Holocaust, and I'm sure pretty much every university in America has something similar. But I was never really, like, emotionally tied into it. It was something that once I sort of saw how corrupt modern politics really were, how the two-party system were basically controlled by the same elite corporate financial interests, and how just fake the whole two-party system was, I was open to all sorts of different ideas. I came across a 9/11 truth group, and that's really what kind of led me into all this other stuff.
Mm-hmm. That's the same thing with this man, my mentor. That was the same entry point for him, 9/11.
He started researching. Yeah, you know what? And there's been a lot of people that woke up to 9/11, started questioning the official narrative. And then, I mean, once you get to that point, it's like, okay, well, clearly the government and the media lied about virtually every single aspect of what happened on 9/11. Well, what else have they lied about? I mean, 9/11 was such a monumental, game-changing event. And it still is. I mean, it's been, you know, over 20 years since it happened, but it still does sort of set the paradigm of U.S. foreign policy, certainly in the Middle East.
Oh, yeah.
You know what I mean?
And,
so it was a game.
Policy with the Patriot Act. If I
True,
could
yeah.
share a little account of that in my
yeah.
life.
Yeah,
I, at the time, I was living in a cabin in the woods. I didn't have a TV, internet, you know. And I went to town on September 12th. And a man I knew, he knew I grew up in the Northeast, and he did too. We were in the Northwest at the time, and he said, look, you got to come to my house and see this on television. It's like, you don't know what happened, right? You don't have any idea of the news. I'm like, what news? Well, he took me into his home. We turned on the TV and flipped a couple channels, and immediately you're seeing the video of the towers collapsing. And immediately I said to myself, and I said to him, that's controlled demolition. That's deliberate. And partly because I didn't have any hypnotic suggestions by the media. You know, they try to steer people's mind into saying it was like the impact of planes and jet fuel melting girders and pancake theory. But I didn't have any of that pre-planted. And I think I also had a healthy doubt of government narratives and court historians. But then I went on. It took me years later, after I was introduced to revisionism, maybe by 2017, when I encountered the work of Christopher Bolin. It was in this man's library that was at my house, Solving 9/11, The Deception That Changed the World. And here, again, all trails led back to Jews, you know, Zionist Jews in America and Israeli Mossad. The real architects and executors and cover-up artists of 9/11 were Zionist Jews. And so many of these trails, as we track revisionism, lead back to Jews. That was a great revelation for me in historical revisionism.
And oh, yeah.
Of course, includes the whole topic of what I call the Jewish issue.
Yeah, no doubt. Yeah, it was definitely a big wake-up call to me. I mean, I was, prior to even looking into 9/11, I was already, like, aware that the establishment, the media establishment, the political establishment, the financial establishment was corrupt beyond anybody's wildest imagination. I mean, you know, even skeptics of the government and media and stuff didn't even understand the extent of how bad it really was. You know what I mean?
Yes.
But yeah,
far enough, John. I think that's operating principle for revisionists is to assume we're not going far enough, and we're encouraged not to with the limited hangout strategy.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. Well, yeah. And once you kind of delve into this stuff, there are a million different websites and podcasts and blogs and personalities presenting information from a dissident perspective. It took a long time to really kind of figure out what was really going on. In fact, I'll mention this. I'm sure I've mentioned this on previous podcasts where I've talked about sort of like my awakening. But one of the first revisionist topics that I encountered was actually Jim Condit Jr.'s like 2-hour video presentation where he explains his thesis that Hitler was like a Rothschild agent.
Mm.
And I was like fascinated by it. I didn't know what to make of it. I mean, I never really, you know, looked too much into World War II, but I was very interested now, like in all sorts of dissident ideas and perspectives. And, you know, as I mentioned, I knew we were being lied to about 9/11 and all these current events. And I thought logically, okay, well, if we're being lied to about all this current stuff going on, I'm sure we've been lied to about all sorts of historical topics. So that kind of got me looking into World War II and Hitler and National Socialism. And I just wanted to get to the bottom of it. Like, what the heck was Hitler really all about? It sort of triggered something in me. And man, I just like you, and just like probably anybody that sort of wakes up to this stuff, you will read and read and read and just, you know, you sort of consume yourself in this sort of material just to really get to the bottom of things and figure out what's what and make up your own mind, you know?
Yes, exactly. I need to mention that this presentation that Adolf Hitler was a Rothschild is part of a resurgence of what is masquerading as historical revisionism, but is actually a reemergence of what you might call ongoing Jewish anti-German war propaganda. It tries to present itself as a kind of revisionism, but it's really not. It's just more of the same war propaganda. And there's a whole, renewal of it in our times, particularly this idea that the Nazis were into the occult and were followers of Madame Blavatsky and the Theosophy, and the Thule Society was a satanic cult, and it's all just nonsense, but it appears to be a kind of revisionism. See what I'm saying?
Yes, absolutely, yeah.
And so you penetrated through that, and that might have been your entry point, but you realized that's not the truth. And maybe that's a segue into our discussion of my first essay in the Barnes Review, Hitler versus the Rothschilds.
Yeah, absolutely. I definitely want to talk about that. And let me just mention before we do, After seeing this presentation by Jim Condit Jr., and there's other people that continue to promote this narrative about Hitler, either being a puppet of like British intelligence, I've heard, or he worked for the Rothschilds, or was actually, you know, an illegitimate child of a Rothschild. I've heard that as well. There's all these different ideas and different theories and narratives out there. But the first thing I did, I was like, okay, well, what did Hitler actually say? And I read Mein Kampf. And it is the most insightful and powerful book I've ever read. And I challenge anybody listening that doubts that to sit down and read it read it for yourself and figure out, you know, what do you think about what this man had to say? He had so many powerful and insightful things to say about all sorts of topics. It wasn't just about the Jew. I mean, and that's kind of what I was thinking, like, okay, this is going to be like all about the Jews and why he hates the Jews. But it was nothing of the sort. It was a very detailed and scholarly and very nuanced like just explanation of the world and the history of his, of, you know, his involvement in politics and his philosophy and National Socialism. So it was very, 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 very different than what I was expecting, mm-hmm. to say the least. And it
all
put
of it.
And it put to bed this idea that Hitler was some sort of agent of the New World Order. Here was a man that was accurately explaining exactly what was going on, who the bad guys were, what needed to be done to solve the problems. Like, he really had this stuff figured out.
Yeah.
So, yeah, let's get into your article. And again, it was the September-October 2021 issue of the Barnes Review. And the article was dealing with Hitler against the Rothschilds. I think that was the title of it, correct?
Well, there's three different titles. There's one on the cover page. There's one in the table of contents. And there's one on the actual, you know, page.
I should have said that was the theme. The theme of the article was it like Hitler against the Rothschilds and the moves that he made?
Yes, versus
sort of,
the Rothschilds. Yes.
Yeah.
This is a little story of how I came to submit this. I saw online that Professor Thomas Dalton was taking submissions for a book he was compiling, you know, chapters in a book about the positive contributions of National Socialism. So, you know, eventually I submitted one. And it was this essay, Hitler versus the Rothschilds. But the project collapsed. He wasn't able to carry it off. So I, since I've been reading the Barnes Review, it was coming in the mail, I thought, well, I can submit this to Barnes instead. And that's what I did. And Paul Angel, the editor, was thrilled with it. I was so glad. He really liked it. And it made the cover of the anniversary issue, the double-sized issue. I was just thrilled beyond belief. My first essay was on the cover and really a feature of the magazine.
Yeah, no, that's awesome. That's great to hear. And it's a great topic to write about and cover in the Barnes Review, of course. So do you want to talk about like your views of Hitler and sort of some of the conclusions you've come to about this extremely controversial, still to this day, probably one of the most controversial men in all of history?
Yes.
And one of the most demonized men, of course.
Indeed. But let me mention some of the content of the Hitler versus the Rothschilds article.
Sure, yeah.
I really encourage people to read it. It's got a great deal of detail and quotes from Hitler and the Rothschilds and quite a number of others. So there were five Rothschilds that were imprisoned by the National Socialist Party at the time, starting in 1938, immediately after the Anschluss, the reunion of Germany and Austria, which formally happened on March 12th, 1938. And by April 7th, Louis Rothschild, the major Jewish Rothschild banker in Europe, was imprisoned. And the assets of his bank were confiscated. You know, there's a great deal of detail on that story. First, I established like the power that the Rothschilds had in Europe, which was all but total, from the book by Werner Sombart, The Jews and Modern Capitalism. That's even going back to the mid-1800s. And the Jewish power, Rothschild power only expanded by 1938. So this was a very powerful group, family, and the National Socialist campaign of imprisoning them was that itself was a sufficient reason for World War II. And it was a very bold move by the National Socialists. But they went on to imprison Alain and Ellie Rothschild, the sons of Robert Rothschild, who were in the British officer corps. They were imprisoned in German prisons during the war as POWs. So a great deal to say about that. And then Victor Rothschild's aunt, Aranka, was imprisoned by the National Socialists at the Buchenwald prison. And there was the usual stories that she was like murdered and beaten to death by the guards, but there's no evidence for that. Classic exaggerations, German atrocities. Incidentally, there was a sixth Rothschild, although she was an in-law. She was actually French. Elizabeth was imprisoned at Ravensbrück She died of typhus, although it was said she was also brutally murdered by evil Nazis. But then the biggest story in the essay is about George Mandel. He was a French diplomat and a member of parliament. He held the cabinet position of Secretary of the Interior, I think. Really elaborate story. He was a Rothschild. His name was Louis George Rothschild. He also went by Jeroboam Rothschild. But he took his mother's maiden name and his middle name, George Mandel, you know, hiding the fact. And he was thought to be the French Winston Churchill, because he opposed the National Socialists. He opposed the Munich Agreement that maintained peace in Europe. He opposed the armistice with Germany after, the German military basically subdued the French and British in the war in the West. And he opposed the creation of the Vichy government.
Yeah, you know what? You just cut out for about 6 seconds. Where you cut off, you had said that this particular Rothschild that you're referring to opposed the Vichy government in France.
And that's then right, George Mandel.
Yep.
And only 14% of the French parliament opposed the Vichy government. So it was quite popular. There's a whole story around the German occupation of France that is utterly different than the official narratives. But just in the interest of time, extraordinary story of how George Mandel was transferred from the Vichy confinement. You know, he was their prisoner. They turned him over to the Gestapo, and they apparently allowed George Mandel to be seized by the Milice. The Milice was a French nationalist paramilitary group, and the Milice then took Rothschild off to a forest near Paris and executed him. The whole story around that, with the assassination of Henriot, the French Goebbels, the Minister of Information of the Vichy, and
Where you left off, you had said the French minister of propaganda had, I don't know if you'd said that he had been executed in a forest or.
No, Henriot was the Vichy Minister of Information, and he was assassinated by the Maquis, who are communist subversives in France. They were the enemy of the Milice. So it looks like the German Gestapo allowed the Milice to abduct George Mandel during a prison transfer. The Germans were transporting him to Paris, where he was being held as a hostage. I think they were trying to arrange a hostage transfer. But the Milice abducted him during this prison transfer, and I have to imagine the Germans allowed it. And then they took him off and executed Mandel. And Churchill was involved in all this. There's a whole story there, but those are the five Rothschilds that the Germans imprisoned at the time, starting in 1938.
Yeah, no, it's a fascinating story, and it kind of maybe you could kind of describe like their overall like broader policy towards the Jews, because this is something that whenever I try to talk to people that aren't, you know, sort of aware of revisionism or have never really looked into this, it's like one of those knee jerk reactions, like they just assume that Hitler and the Germans hated the Jews for no reason, and, you know, they wanted to kill them all during the Holocaust, which, I mean, is obviously not true at all, but, like, how would you describe, like, what their actual policy was? Because clearly, they did say some negative things about the Jews and had some very powerful and harsh critiques of just what the Jews were up to, you know, in the media, in entertainment, in the government, in banking, you know, with the Rothschilds, for example. So, I mean, they were obviously critics and opponents outright of the Jews, but what was their actual policy towards them, and why is it so difficult for people to objectively, like, assess this topic?
Well, they stated their policy towards the Jews in many ways, quite openly, including in their early laws, the so-called Nuremberg Laws. The law of German citizenship was one of those. Had them written down here. They excluded Jews as being official citizens of Germany. They weren't allowed to vote, and they excluded Jews from certain professions and positions in media ownership and banking. And essentially, based on the studies by the Institute for the Study of the Jewish Question, produced a report in 1938 about the Jewish presence in Weimar Germany before the National Socialist era. And it was devastating. You know, it was just classic German, you know, information, statistics. Jews dominating the media, Jews dominating banking, Jews dominating major industries, and to the point of ruining Germany. And so they expressed that their policy was to basically deport Jews from Germany. And they had some ideas on where, but the Zionists had their own ideas. They wanted them to be deported to Palestine. So the Germans cooperated with that in the Havara Agreement. I'm sure you know the transfer agreement.
Sure, yeah.
And many others. Joseph Goebbels, as well as being the Minister of Information, was also the mayor of Berlin. And he had an openly stated policy of deporting all the Jews out of Berlin. So they never had any extermination policies, although it's interesting, the word exterminate means basically over the border. But we take it to mean, you know, mass killing and the kind of genocide. Well, that was never one of the stated policies of the National Socialists towards Jews. It was all deportation. And but even this was not what you would call absolute. The Germans allowed for Jews to remain in Germany and even participate in business and in the military. There's that book, Hitler's Jewish Soldiers.
Right. Mark Brigg, I think, is the author. Yeah.
Very good.
Yeah, there was definitely exceptions, right? I think one thing that I discovered is, and again, I think this is very difficult for people to, you know, like an average person to think about, is the Germans viewed the Jews as a foreign group of people, as not only a foreign group of people, like a foreign racial group, but as extremely hostile to the interests of the German nation. And I mean, for somebody like us, obviously we recognize that. I mean, this is like the theme of all of history, mm-hmm. is the role that Jews play in society and how they sort of have blended in as like a religious minority or as just like, you know, like a small like minority of people, harmless, you know, benevolent, they never did anything wrong, you know, that sort of mindset. But no, the Jews are extremely well organized and extremely ethnocentric, and recognize themselves openly as a foreign group of people that have interests that often clash with the interests of the nations in which they're residing in. And this was something that the Germans had figured out. And frankly, most other European countries, including many people in America, recognize this as well.
Yes.
But this sort of understanding of who the Jews are as a people has been totally wiped off the record as a result of the Jewish victory in World War II.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. So.
Yes, and their ongoing, from there, dominance of education, media, entertainment. But the Germans, one of the distinctions between Germany and fascist nations such as Italy and Spain was Germany was almost entirely homogenous. It was almost all Germans. The only exception was under 2% Jews, whereas Italy and Spain had some multiracialism. That's a broader ethnic mix. And which some people say is one of the distinctions of National Socialism to fascism in general, is it includes a racial focus. And Germans well knew that the greatest threat to Germany was Bolshevism. And they well knew that Bolshevism was primarily a Jewish ideology and aggressive, you know, political structure. In fact, Bavaria was briefly taken over by a Bolshevik revolution in 1919. And that's where Hitler in 1923 conducted the so-called Beer Hall Putsch, or coup, to try to basically rescue the government of Bavaria from another communist takeover. And that's a whole fascinating story, how the Freikorps, a German militia group composed of World War I veterans, reconvened with their officers and took up arms and fought an actual battle in the cities and in the countryside against communist forces and succeeded.
Right.
So yes, by all means,
yeah, that's
it. Germans well knew that the greatest threat to Germany were Jews in various forms, economically, the media, and in Bolshevism. That was the great threat to Europe. That's what the truth. You know, John, most people don't even understand the basic conflict of World War II and who the two sides were. You know, they think it's the Allies versus the Axis, and the purpose of World War II is to prevent the evil Axis from taking over the world. That's not the basics of World War II. The two combatants were, on the one side, were Jewish bankers and basically Jewish Bolsheviks, with the exception of Stalin, who was pretty well surrounded by Jewish communists like Lazar Kaganovich. And that's one side. On the other side were basically the ethno-nationalists, you know, the free market populist fascists and their allies. And the dispute was not over, you know, the evil Nazis taking over the world. The dispute was over primarily Jewish bankers and communists taking over the world.
Right. Yeah. It was a total clash of worldviews and how the world was going to, you know, was going to essentially be operated. And I completely agree with you. I think that's a very good way of looking at it. And unfortunately, the forces of Jewish globalism, you know, Jewish, you know, plutocracy and communism prevailed in that conflict. And
yes,
it's led to the world that we see today. Yeah,
exactly. I say that very thing. I'd say my greatest dispute now with people is over this perception of Hitler and the National Socialists as being Rothschild's agents or, you know, playing a role in generating World War II, you know, for the purposes of destroying Europe and killing off millions of Christians. And like Hitler was an agent who was willingly participating in. But maybe that's a lead into our discussion of the essay about Hitler's olive branches, Hitler peacemaker.
Yeah, no, it is. I was just going to say, I mean, that sort of theory that Hitler was like an agent that was set out to sort of to create or instigate this wider world war, that totally ignores all of the peace offers that he bent over backwards making with all the countries surrounding him, Poland, the United Kingdom. I mean, pretty much all the major players in Europe anyways.
Oh, yeah.
The article that you put together was excellent. There was also I should mention the article that we're referring to, Hitler's World War II Olive Branches, it's a synopsis of the peace offers that he made, and it was published in the May-June 2022 issue of the Barnes Review. And in that very same issue, there's also a couple really good articles by John Weir, who's another historian who publishes pretty extensively with the Barnes Review. He writes these very very detailed but concise and well-sourced articles about World War II, essentially. And he wrote one on Hitler's decision to invade Poland, where he was essentially relying on neutral sources to explain Hitler's very legitimate rationale for invading Poland, frankly. In that very same issue, I should also mention that we actually published Hitler's remarks to the Reichstag explaining his reasoning and justification for the invasion of Poland. So anyways, I just wanted to mention that. Those sort of dovetail very well with the article that we're going to talk about now.
Yes, that is an awesome area of revision, and that specific reasons for the German-Polish conflict. Barnes publishes a book, which I have here, by Udo Wilendy, the great German historian. My version is called Truth for Germany, the Guilt Question of the Second World War. But I see on the Barnes website they have a new title for that now. But it's this book. It's like, you know, hundreds of pages devoted exclusively to the conflict between Germany and Poland and the so-called outbreak of World War II. And that's a wonderful book that Barnes produces. The other one is The Forced War by David L. Hagen, another 800-page book devoted to like 1 2/3 years of history, 1938 and 1939, up until September 1st, when the German Wehrmacht was forced into entering Poland.
Yes, I'm actually, I was trying to find John Weir's book. I think it's just called Germany's War.
Yes.
Where he explains, he explains basically the origins and aftermath of World War II. And, I mean, again, this idea that either Hitler, you know, wanted this war, he was like an agent, you know, on behalf of the bankers or the globalists to provoke this war, or the idea that he was this, you know, maniacal evil monster that wanted to like take over the world. I mean, both of these, like the mainstream view and then this more like conspiratorial type view, are just totally bogus when you actually get into the source material and actually listen to what he had to say, read what he had to say, you know.
Yeah, totally bogus.
You know what I mean? Yeah, exactly. I mean,
The revisionism is so, so much more impressive. Its quality is so much better when you compare it to like court historian history books on World War II. The quality, the source material, you know, the primary source material. David Irving also to be included in this.
Yeah, absolutely.
The essay you're talking about, like you said, was in May, June 2022. It was called Hitler's Olive Branches. I wanted to call it Hitler Peacemaker, just as, for the shock value, you know, shock the normies, because they all think of Hitler as a warmonger. But it's based on the book What the World Rejected, Hitler's Peace Offers, 1933 to 1940, by Dr. Frederick Steve. That's a Ostara Publications. They put out good works. And it was published in, well, it gives the dates of the original publications, 1940, 1945. So long list of peace proposals, arms reduction treaties, economic alliances, non-aggression pacts that Adolf Hitler made starting in 1933, right away in May, just a few months after he was appointed chancellor. And the article is shaped, Paul, Angel, and I worked together to structure the article as a kind of call and response, where Hitler makes the peace proposal, and how did the world or the nations that he proposed it to respond, you know, one after the other. And the responses are all negative. They either ignored them.
Very, very dismissive, yeah.
Or even in many cases, they escalated the buildup to the conflict. Britain escalated its manufacturing of war materials. In one case, France signed an alliance with the Soviet Union as part of the encirclement policy of Germany. You know, this was after Hitler proposed, you know, peace terms with France. So they actually escalated the conflict after the peace proposals.
Right. You know, I couldn't help but read this article and also Hitler's speech, and you immediately see the parallels with what's going on today with Russia and Ukraine. Mm-hmm. There's so many direct parallels to what happened then and what happened leading up to this conflict, where one side is, you know, acting very, I would characterize it as very respectful. I mean, very respectful, very rational, very straightforward, and, you know, basically trying to resolve a very protracted situation, and the other side just being outright hostile towards these efforts, or dismissive, or disrespectful, or it, as you mentioned, sort of operating in a way to further escalate the situation rather than try to legitimately solve the tensions and work out the issues.
Yes.
So, yeah, it's fascinating.
There's a lot of comparisons with the Russia-Ukraine conflict, with the basically World War II, not just Germany and Poland, but Germany and Russia.
Right.
And some areas it's valid, some not. But I want to mention that some of these statements that Hitler made in the peace proposals, they're so just so extraordinary. For instance, right away on March 16th, 1935, in a peace proposal to France, he called for the complete international outlawry of all bombing. Okay, you know, here's the warmonger. He wants aerial bombing.
Yeah, what kind of like genocidal warmongering, you know, evildoer is this guy like openly advocating for, you know, outlawing bombing? Yeah. Yeah, I mean, well, Hitler saw the devastation of war during World War I and wanted to avoid that at all costs.
Oh yeah.
I mean, that was one of his primary, you know, driving forces in negotiating these deals, or attempting to negotiate these deals, and just conducting foreign policy in Europe in general, was to prevent and avoid another conflict.
Absolutely. I have some quotes on that. By March 1936, that was his most extensive peace proposal. It had 19 points. But the goal, he said, was the peace of Europe and social happiness and economic prosperity of the nations. I just find it, that's why I wanted to call it Hitler Peacemaker, because the things he actually said are in such a stark contrast to the depictions of this evil warmonger. One of the 19 points was it called for a 25-year non-aggression pact among the nations. No aggression, 25 years. One of the more interesting points was point 25, which called for the education of children and youth and the use of media should not be devoted towards like antagonism and engendering contempt and conflict between the nations. So it really interests me that, like, and other governments did this too. They dictated how the media was to be used and the education system. You know, they actually had control over this, and they could devote it to teaching peace and cooperation and alliances between the nations. Of course, our media is doing the exact opposite, as you say, with Ukraine. And it's not really government controlled. It's privately controlled by bankers and primarily by Jews.
Right.
There's a lot we can say about, really encourage people to read this essay, some of the things that were said. The Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact, August 23rd, 1939, has to be mentioned. It's considered a Hitler peace proposal, but it was really a non-aggression pact between Soviet Union and Germany, because Hitler knew he had to conduct this war with Poland, and he couldn't have the Soviets invading him during this time. But both sides planned to break this pact. The Soviets, with Stalin, his real name was Lubek Djugashvili, he was planning to time his invasion of Germany and all of Europe until after the war in the West. He was encouraging Germany and France and Britain into a conflict, because that would exhaust those European nations for the Soviet takeover. So Stalin was waiting, using the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact as a timing mechanism for when he would invade. And Hitler was using it as timing to so he could deal with the British and French first, and then launch the preemptive strike against the Soviets before they can invade, known as Operation Barbarossa. So it's considered a peace agreement that Hitler made, but it was really one both sides were planning to break for strategic reasons.
Right. Interesting. Now, I got to ask you, what role does Poland play in all of this? And to what extent was Poland being manipulated in sort of like a proxy war with, you know, England and France to a lesser extent, and I guess the Soviet Union to an even lesser extent? But it almost seemed, I mean, again, you can draw the parallels with Ukraine, how the Ukraine has been manipulated by Western forces in a proxy war against Russia. It was basically the same thing going on back then, only, you know, leading up to World War II, it was Poland being manipulated and sort of, used to provoke Germany, right?
Oh, yes. And let's not leave out the United States and the FDR administration, largely dominated by Zionist Jews and communist Jews in the administration. I wouldn't...
Communist agents outright, many of them.
Oh, yes.
Like literally Soviet. Working for the Soviets, yeah.
There's a lot to say about that. I recommend the book Freedom Betrayed by Herbert Hoover, who was the president before FDR. But I wouldn't place the Soviets and Stalin too far down in the manipulation of Poland. Stalin was quite active in provoking the war. That was in his strategic interest to get the Western European nations to fight each other, to weaken them up for the Soviet invasion. There's a lot of details to this. Neville Henderson was the British ambassador to Germany, and Edmund Halifax was the foreign minister of Britain. Together, they like conducted a deception of Germany. They told Germany that the Poles were willing to negotiate, and they told the Poles that the Germans were ready to invade. Okay, lying to both sides. This is at the crucial time towards the end of August, just before the actual military conflict. That's all presented both in Udo Wilendy's book, Truth for Germany, and in The Forced War by David Hagen. Those are the best sources of how Poland was manipulated. Quite cleverly. I mean, the details are just extraordinary. And really, all the nations were manipulating Poland. The greatest manipulation being the unconditional guarantee that Britain and France gave to Poland that if anyone were to invade them, Britain and France would declare war on that invader. And this just encouraged the Poles.
Right. Yeah. No, it is fascinating. And those details are not presented in mainstream history, obviously.
No. Oh, no, German was the aggressor. Hey, I'd really like to read some of the quotes from the article. Not my writing, but some of the things Hitler said in the article, Hitler's Olive Branches. Can I do that?
Yeah, please do.
It's just quite a lot, what he said here. The National Socialist Movement has delivered Germany from the Jewish capitalist shackles imposed by plutocratic, democratic, dwindling class of exploiters. Jews and Freemasons, international traders and stock traders were responsible for World War II. Quote, if Mr. Churchill or any other warmongers had but a fraction of the sense of responsibility I felt towards Europe, they could not have played so perfidious a game. It still saddens me today that, in spite of all my endeavors, I have not succeeded in obtaining this friendship with England, which, I believe, should have been a blessing for both peoples, especially because I was not able to do so despite my persistent, sincere efforts. Quote, it was not my ambition to wage wars, but to build up a new social state of the highest culture, and every year of war takes me away from my work. Now, that's a very significant statement by Hitler. His real goals and his life calling and his vision was to build up German nation to a magnificent culture, the Thousand-Year Reich. And it included programs such as eugenics that would genetically improve the German stock. You know, not a heresy, you know. A magnificent and comprehensive vision for the splendor of the German society. That was his real goal. He's no interest in taking over other nations or waging wars. I find that to be like just an astonishing revelation.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And again, totally contrary to how most people would assume, you know, Hitler operated, right?
Right. This is the power of, you know, studying revisionism. It's just revelatory. One last quote here from Hitler's final political testament, April 29th, 1945. He's in the bunker. You know, the Soviets' Red Army is approaching from the east, and the British and Americans largely, a few other Canadians coming from the west, and he's doomed. And the war is over. He makes his final political testament. Quote, It is not true that I or anyone else in Germany wanted the war of 1939. It was desired and instigated exclusively by those international statesmen who were either of Jewish origin or who worked for Jewish interests. I have made too many offers for the control and limitation of armaments that posterity will not be able to disregard forever for the responsibility for the outbreak of this war to be laid on me. I have furthermore never wished that, after the first disastrous World War, a second should arise against England, much less against America.
Wow.
And he goes on.
Yeah, I was going to say, I remember reading that for the first time and just being blown away at how not only powerful, but just how truly righteous this man was.
Yeah, exactly. That's one of the great revelations. Is the person we've been told is the world's most evil monster emerges from an honest study as being one of the great heroes and one of the truly moralistic and good-hearted people. I think Adolf Hitler had a profound sense of empathy and compassion. And that's clear in his love of animals. You know, Germany passed the first laws against animal cruelty. They banned vivisection, which is the live dissection of animals. But also for people, he was highly empathetic, especially towards the German people. He was heartbroken by their suffering during the Weimar period. And his great motivation was to, you know, make their lives better, help them be better people and live better lives. I mean, this is like the exact inversion of what we're told about this evil man.
Yep. Well, like everything related to the official narrative of World War II, including the depiction of Hitler and National Socialism, and of course the alleged Jewish Holocaust, I mean, it literally is an inversion. It's like the exact opposite of what we've been led to believe, yeah.
And to extraordinary extremes. So
yeah.
Let me, a couple more quotes to finish out this essay that summarize Hitler's position on war and peacemaking, and also who's responsible. He goes on to describe, quote, whom we have to thank for all this, international Jewry and its helpers. He identifies international conspirators in money and finance, and the people that is really guilty of this murderous conflict, Jewry, and there's an exclamation point. And then finally, above all, I enjoin the leaders of the nation and their followers to scrupulous observance of the laws of race and to merciless resistance to the universal poisoner of all peoples, international Jewry. And there he's speaking to the Germans that are going to survive him after the war and have to deal with the surrender terms. International Jewry.
Right.
He was clear on who the enemy was. And we should be too.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And I know that that sort of alienates a lot of people, you know, in modern America and like in the modern West, saying mean things about Jews or criticizing Jews. But there's a lot of very valid reasons to actually, you know, to criticize Jews. I mean, he was, you know, basically speaking the truth about what was going on and who was causing all the problems. And I know that might sound like a very simplistic way of looking at the situation, but it's really not if you get down into the details. And, you know, he explained these things at length. And I think, honestly, I think that is one of the biggest reasons why he had to be so not only demonized, but just utterly annihilated. Like the whole political movement had to be literally genocided and wiped off the face of the earth, was because not only did they, you know what was really going on, and they, you know, that like openly explained it to people in a very straightforward, frank way. They were not afraid of addressing the Jewish problem or the Jewish question and explaining what was really going on with these people and what they were up to. They took serious moves to check their power and to prevent them from continuing to manipulate and subvert and, you know, basically destroy the country.
Right. Yes. And not only Germany. I mean, many, many prominent and, you know, credible people have presented the Jewish issue. In fact, just to close out here, there's a supplemental chapter in What the World Rejected that I speak about in the article, it comes from the Forrestal Diaries. James Forrestal was the Secretary of the Navy of the U.S. during World War II, and he became the first Secretary of Defense afterward. And he has in his diaries, he had a conversation with Joseph Kennedy, who was the U.S. ambassador to Britain. And Kennedy says he had a meeting with Neville Chamberlain, who at the time was the previous Prime Minister of Great Britain. And Kennedy says Chamberlain told him, quote, "America and the world Jews had forced England into the war." Now, I make the point in the article that since America was essentially, even at that time, dominated by world Jews, this statement is kind of redundant. Basically, world Jews forced England into the war.
Yeah, yeah, well, it's true. I mean, yeah, it's...
I'm afraid so.
It's, may be difficult to come to grips with, but it's absolutely 100% true.
It's not difficult for me anymore. Sometimes I tell people the number two problem in the United States is that we can hardly even talk about the number one problem. And sometimes they say, oh, well, what's the one number one problem? I say, well, we can't talk about it.
Right.
What do you think it is? And like, and then there's a quote attributed to Voltaire, not his real name. And it's, as historians, you know, we have to recognize it's not well sourced. It may not be Voltaire, but the point is clear. In order to find out who rules over you, in order to find out who rules over you, find out who you can't criticize. And that leads people to the Jewish issue. They pretty quickly realize, oh, well, you really can't criticize Jews, can you?
You can't criticize them. You can barely even say the word Jew out loud without, you know, getting a dirty look from somebody or somebody, you know, it's almost like a vulgarity even saying that word out loud. It's incredible. And it's all tied into this story that they've told about World War II.
Yep.
This totally fictional, fabricated, you know, distorted Jewish myth of World War II. That's exactly what it is. It's like a Jewish horror film that is designed, and the propaganda is crafted to psychologically exploit a target audience.
Oh yes, quite sophisticated.
It's a form of psychological warfare, and you know using psychological trauma to implant this narrative in the masses' minds.
Yeah, I find it's crumbling, John. I think it's worth challenging. I will use the J word in public conversation, and I'm not getting the same hyper reaction from everyone. Some people are getting it. It's you know, suppressed, and they're awkward and anxious about hearing it or discussing it. They don't always like react with that hysteria. I think it's crumbling, and it's worth pushing it.
Oh, absolutely. I've been pushing it fairly openly since 2009. So yeah, we've definitely, and I can say for sure, we've definitely made a lot of progress, but as in any struggle, it's sort of like a sort of never ending. You know, we're always going to be out there trying to set the record straight and get this information out to people.
Yes.
And, you know, to kind of wrap up, I want to go ahead and wrap up the conversation. There are some other topics we didn't get to, but I'd like to maybe schedule another podcast in the future. This was a great conversation, and I love the articles that you put together, not only for the Barnes Review, but also the articles I've read over at the Occidental Observer. But I just wanted to wrap this up and say, you know, we've talked about fake history, fake news. And you know, again, I think people that read the Barnes Review or that would listen to this podcast, they know that this has been going on literally for generations. And the enemies of truth and justice, namely like the organized Jewish community, they have falsified history and created a totally weaponized narrative that's designed specifically to delegitimize and demonize the white race and its accomplishments, and really pathologize any form of a positive white racial identity or solidarity. And it all goes back to World War II. It's inescapable. And frankly, I don't think we could ever solve any of the problems facing our world today without confronting this truth head on.
I agree. Yeah, I'm so glad to see that you understand, as I do, the crucial importance of World War II truth today.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
Just briefly mention my third article in the Barnes Review. It's March-April 2022. It's called The Third Reich's Policy Towards German Women. And this was the second chapter I submitted to Thomas Dalton's book, you know, that I resubmitted to, you know, The Positive Contributions of National Socialism, resubmitted to Barnes. And I, you know, we don't have time, but I have to say that I've reread this article myself a number of times, and every time it just brings tears to my eyes. I'm just so touched in my heart by this beautiful recognition of the feminine role in the society, in the nation, and the enthusiasm with which the women of Germany took up their service to the German people and the German nation, and how that was supported by the German government, the National Socialists. It's really heartwarming, and you just long for such a thing in our society today, with the Marxist feminism, this horror story of transgenderism, and, you know, just the awful filth, you know, in feminism today, and that just the beauty and the wholesome goodness and the natural approach that the National Socialists took towards women.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's a big topic, and next time we'll definitely start off and focus on that article and talk about it in much more detail, because there is a lot that needs to be said when it comes to, you know, when it comes specifically to that topic. But I couldn't agree with you more, and it's just another example of how totally fraudulent the mainstream understanding of National Socialist Germany is. I mean, they cared very deeply about women, about fostering positive, healthy relationships between men and women, about creating and ensuring mothers were well cared for and respected in society, and that's totally been thrown out the window in modern America. Mm. And we see the results. Our country is a total mess.
Exactly.
And
by design.
By design, by the same people who were promoting this stuff in Weimar Germany. It's the same ethnic group. In many cases, it's the descendants of the very people who were promoting this stuff back then, just living in America today. Yeah.
Yes.
It's insane.
I listened to the interview you did with Paul Angel on this program, and you discuss the two of you discuss my article on women and National Socialism, so people can listen to that episode, and they'll get some exploration of that article by you two.
Yes, absolutely. And you can find that over at barnesreview.org, where you will also find this podcast and, of course, all the excellent revisionist books for sale and details on how to subscribe to the magazine. So with that said, Carl, thank you very much for taking the time to speak with me today. This was an excellent conversation. One, again, that was or probably was long overdue. And I hope we can do this more regularly, because there is no shortage of topics to discuss.
I would be overjoyed. That was wonderful interviewing with you today and sharing some of this knowledge. One last point. My next essay is coming out in the next issue, which is devoted to ancient civilizations. So I have a different topic that I study. My essay is about the elongated skulls and that are humanoid but not Homo sapiens, that are found in proximity to the ancient megalithic sites, you know, the ancient civilization temples and cities. So that issue should be very interesting on far ancient history.
Yeah, that's going to be the September-October issue, I believe. And that's going to be a really interesting issue of the Barnes Review. A little bit different. than some of the other topics. We pretty much cover every issue relating to World War II. So yeah, it's going to be a fascinating issue. And again, now would be a perfect time to subscribe to the magazine if you're not already. That issue should be published in the next month or so, and then of course mailed out to everybody. So definitely looking forward to that, and definitely looking forward to doing this again in the future, Carl.
Me too. Thank you, John. I'm looking forward to it.
Okay, thanks, man. I will talk to you soon, and keep up the good work.
You too. Good day.
Thank you.